Hello, hello. Welcome back to Loki's Librarian. If you are new here, welcome. I am your librarian, Katrina, and this is where I am reading through the enormous library of books you see behind me. And then I give you a quick synopsis and tell you what I think about them. So if you like books, just aren't sure what to read next, hit that subscribe button, like and share my videos, and let me know what you think in the comments. It is the last Sunday of the month, which means it's time for the next President book, making this week's book of the week, Man of the People, A Life of Harry S. Truman by Alonzo L. Hamby. The accompanying cocktail is a Missouri Mule, which was apparently made with Truman in mind. It is 1 ounce of bourbon, 1 ounce of applejack or apple brandy, a half ounce of Campari, and a half ounce of Cointreau. So let's do this. Harry S. Truman was born on May 8, 1884 in Lamar, Missouri to John and Martha Truman. He was the second born but first surviving child, would be joined by younger brother John Vivian and sister Mary Jane. Truman is named for his mother's brother Harrison, and the S does not actually stand for anything. It was kind of put in as a generic nod to both grandfathers, paternal grandfather Anderson Ship Truman and maternal grandfather Solomon Young. Ah, I did it again. Honey, I did the stupid thing again where I left my measuring cup downstairs. Do you mind? I'm sorry. I am just a hot mess today. Battery died on the microphone. I have pinched sciatic nerve. Cut myself opening up the new battery. Yeah, I'm just doing well today. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Truman was a true native son of Missouri. He was born and raised there, lived there all his life until he left for Washington, D.C., and we would return there after he left the presidency. He was quite young when he was diagnosed as having very weak eyesight. I mean, he's essentially blind without glasses and was prescribed very thick glasses, which he wore for the remainder of his life. Now, the Trumans tried to make a living as farmers, and his father experienced some success initially, especially with, like, livestock trading. He was pretty good at identifying, you know, good animals and when to sell them and when not to sell them. But eventually, he would end up in debt. The family would struggle with debt off and on, except for Vivian, the second son. He tended to do quite well for himself. How well, we're going to come back to in just a minute. Now, Truman went through school locally and only completed, like, 1 year at a local college. He never graduated, but while he was there, he learned, like, bookkeeping, basic accounting, and those courses helped him to land a job at a bank. And he worked at the bank for several years and was quite successful. He probably could have made a go of it as a banker. He was good at advocating for himself and earned promotions and pay raises, but he didn't want to be a banker, and eventually he left to help out at the family farm. Now, when World War II hit, he volunteered with the Missouri Reserves and did a fight in the trenches, seeing action, and was in charge of Battery D. I forget the specific reserve unit. His reserve unit is in the book, but I don't remember exactly what it was, but he fought with them. Ooh. Yay, I've killed a tiny bottle of Campari. I still have another tiny bottle of Campari, so that's fine. But Battery D was kind of the problem child of the reserve unit, and he got them to follow his lead. And that actually tells you quite a bit about him as a leader. I mean, a lot more than what the author kind of danced around, because problem children don't usually just follow people. So there must have been something to him if he got them all to follow him and obey his orders, especially in actual combat. Shit. There we go. Too much Cointreau initially. Now, for those of you with math skills or without math skills, I'm about to tell you, he was 33 when he entered the war. This is all to say that it's never too late to make something of yourself. He went to war at 33. Let me stir this up. You know, I've never actually had just Cointreau, but that was pretty tasty, actually. If you're feeling like a little orange-flavored liqueur, Cointreau is pretty awesome. Now, when he returned from the war, he opted not to enlist in the regular army. So several of his compatriots did exactly that, and they took their ranks with them. He resigned his commission with the reserves, and he returned to the private sector. He never served in the military again. But he still maintained close ties with his brothers from Battery D. And when he was in the private sector, he opened a haberdashery in Missouri. Now, this was not necessarily a bad idea. When he'd been in the reserves, he had operated a small cantina on base, which was basically the only successful cantina that the reserves had. However, his cantina in the reserves was largely successful because he didn't have much by way of competition. I mean, other cantinas opened, but they weren't very well run. He was essentially the only one who had any bookkeeping experience, so he was able to turn a profit. The haberdashery was not successful because he had lots of competition at a time in America when business was booming everywhere. When the economy just took off, as you recall, from my books on Harding and Coolidge. Less so Hoover, but... The Campari is kind of a very strong flavor profile there. You'd think the Applejack would compete with it a little better, but I'm getting a lot of Campari. A little bit of sour. Eventually, he and his partner had to shut the business down, and while his partner would file bankruptcy to get out from under his business debts, Truman never did. He basically just kicked the debt can down the road for as long as he possibly could, eventually getting out from underneath when his brother Vivian would purchase the banknotes from creditors and retire the debt. Family helps family. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not judging him. That's certainly one way to do it. My point is he never filed bankruptcy to say, hey, I'm just never going to pay it. He just maneuvered and avoided paying it until the problem resolved itself, basically. He did marry his childhood sweetheart and longtime girlfriend, Bess Wallace, in 1919, so he'd have been 35. They had had a long courtship, mostly due to Bess's mother did not want to be without her daughter. Bess had had many other suitors, but basically none of them had the staying power to outlast Mama Wallace, and it's largely due to Truman's willingness to share Bess rather than move her across country that Mama Wallace eventually gave her blessing. And that remained true. When Truman was in the White House, when he was a senator, Bess spent most of her time in Missouri and he would just travel back and forth. When he was in the White House, Mama Wallace came with. She lived in the White House with them. Nothing against that either. Most of the presidents had extended family staying with them in the White House. So that's all par for the course. No problems there. I'm not judging him. I'm just informational. That's why that's in there. Let's see here. The couple had one daughter, Margaret, who was born February 17, 1924. They were both, Bess and Harry were both 39 when their daughter was born. Now, after his business failed, Truman went into local politics and would more or less remain a politician for the rest of his life. I think he had, was like between 4 and 6 years when he lost his first office in a race until he was voted back in and then remained in politics consistently. And those 4 to 6 years he kind of spent as a farmer working his mother's farm for her. Now, politics in Missouri were dirty business, and I am sure the Republicans had their own machine, but the focus of this book being Truman, the author went into great detail on the Democratic machine, specifically under boss Tom Pendergast. Truman met Pendergast through his nephew Joseph Pendergast, so it was Pendergast's nephew Joseph, who had served with Truman in the war. Pendergast was impressed and started to support Truman in his races. Now, Pendergast was unquestionably dirty and would eventually serve jail time for some of that dirt, but there does not seem to be any historical indication that Truman was dirty as well. His political life actually tends to be pretty clean, and the only thing he's guilty of is throwing jobs to his friends and family, which is no more than any other politician has done since the country started. So again, no blame there. It's just what is. After serving locally and doing quite well, actually, he oversaw the expansion of roads in Missouri and did everything he could to balance local budgets. Truman was put forward as a candidate for U.S. Senator in 1934. And after winning, he did quite well as a senator. He was liked across party lines, got a lot of bipartisan support on things, on bills and issues that he put forward. He got along with almost everyone. And that's actually one of his great strengths, is that he was a genuinely likable guy. While senator, he actually managed to make a name for himself and bring himself to national attention by overseeing Department of Defense expenses during the early part of World War II, specifically with an eye towards cutting out waste and making the ramp up more efficient. And it was this combination of likability and efficiency that made him the Democrats' choice for running mate to FDR in 1944. Now, through all of this, Bess was not thrilled. I mean, she did her duty. She showed up for functions when asked to, but mostly she preferred to be in Missouri with her friends and family. And then April 12, 1945, he was given notice that he was immediately needed at the White House. And when he arrived, Eleanor advised him that Roosevelt had died and Truman needed to take the oath of office, which he did right there. For the first 2 weeks, he kept Roosevelt's cabinet in place while dealing with the immediate emergency of the transition and funeral of Roosevelt. But before long, he began replacing cabinet members with his own picks. Totally fine. It's very middle of the road with him. Like, there's nothing here that's, oh my God, right? He needs people he can work with. And some of his picks were genuinely inspired. Like when he had General George Marshall, who was initially the Army Chief of Staff, take over the position of Secretary of State in January of 1947. The first couple of months were taken up with closing out World War II, which was easily done in Europe, as Hitler kindly offed himself about 2 weeks after Roosevelt passed, although the two events are not in any way, shape, or form related. Russian troops were in Berlin, and Hitler did not want to be captured alive, precipitating his demise by self-inflicted gunshot wound. It was very helpful of him. Ooh, typo. So European victory is assured. Truman travels to Potsdam, Potsdamer is a section of Berlin, and he met there with Churchill and Stalin. The meeting with Churchill was necessarily truncated, as Churchill lost his own re-election as prime minister and was replaced mid-conference with Prime Minister Clement Attlee. Truman initially liked Stalin, and he said that multiple times. Stalin's a good guy. I like him. Called him Uncle Joe. The feelings of goodwill faded rapidly, especially in the post-war years, as Stalin's true character revealed itself with the Berlin barricade and the annexation of huge tracts of Eastern Europe. While at Potsdam, Truman received word of the first successful atomic test in New Mexico, and he was quite pleased because he knew that this was basically an ace in the hole, right? And he advised Stalin of that successful test. Stalin acted like it was no big deal. No congratulations, just like, oh yeah, no, that's a cool deal, bro. Cool story. Nice. Good for you. That was basically very, very low-key reaction. Now, following Potsdam, Truman, I believe, attempted to negotiate an end to the war with Japan, but following heavy losses on both sides at, I believe it was Okinawa, Truman concluded the Japanese... If I'm wrong about that, don't worry, my father will watch this video and tell me. That's fine. I just have no way of correcting. Well, I can put comments in my YouTube commentary. That's all I can do. But if I'm wrong and it wasn't Okinawa, I will be advised of that fact. That's okay. That's how I learn. Truman concluded the Japanese just would not stop fighting. And there were heavy losses on both sides. It wasn't just the American losses. He was also looking at Japanese losses and saying this is not sustainable. And he authorized the dropping of the first bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And the results were awful, obviously. And Truman gave the Japanese a few days to surrender, and when he heard absolutely nothing from them, he dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki. And he actually had a third target picked out and ready to go. But it wasn't needed because the Japanese surrendered after Nagasaki. Only just, though. The emperor was willing and able to surrender. His military leaders did not want him to. And it's only because Emperor Hirohito got his planned speech, his surrender speech, recorded and to radio stations ahead of a coup that was intended by his military leaders that the surrender went through. And the war was officially over. And another inspired choice of Truman's was leaving General Douglas MacArthur as basically governor of Japan. And MacArthur, I don't know much about him. I really don't. I've been looking for a good biography on him, especially after reading this book. But MacArthur left Hirohito with his dignity and basically, instead of just issuing edicts, would discuss them with Hirohito and allow any edicts to pass by way of Hirohito. And when MacArthur left at the start of the Korean War, like, the Japanese were sad. They were like, dude, sorry. Hey, hate to see you go. According to this book. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the Japanese detested him and were like, we're throwing a parade, you're leaving, not because we love you, but because we're glad to see you go. I don't know. I have to read more about MacArthur to know which way that cookie falls. So now Truman is president of a post-war America, and things are looking good. And he's trying to figure out what social programs he wants to back, and he did back early forms of, like, national insurance. So Obamacare is not that original. It goes back to Truman. But he's trying to navigate America's place in the New World. And he hits on three points which actually lay the groundwork for the Cold War and modern geopolitics and basically changed the course of world politics. So the first thing he did is he supported the creation of Israel and the partitioning of Palestine into Jewish and Arab states. And his reasoning was quite blunt, all right? He quite blunt and to the point. He's like, hey, I have a rather large Jewish constituency here in the States that wants it. I don't have that many Muslims here in the States, so I'm going to go with the people who might potentially put me back into office. Quite blunt, quite to the point. And that situation pretty much speaks for itself, right? I mean, we are seeing the fallout of this support since Israel's founding, which it was founded on May 14th, 1948, and within a year had been recognized by the United Nations. It's been an ongoing fallout ever since. And wherever you stand on the Israel-Palestine divide, if you want to know more, I would highly recommend the Martyr Made podcast on the Palestinian conflict. I will include a link in the description, and if I can find one that I can include here, I'll pop it up here too. Now, next up is the Truman Doctrine. And the Truman Doctrine pledges, this has been used by basically every politician since like 1947, or 1950, whenever he actually issued it. The Truman Doctrine pledges American support, quote, for democracies against authoritarian threats. So, and every politician in the interim has used this as their justification for the Korean War, Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, South America. I mean, anywhere American troops are, it's because we feel there's a threat of authoritarianism and democracy must be backed and supported. This was ultimately be the policy on which the global war on terrorism would be based, because terrorists are authoritarian, right? Al-Qaeda was authoritarian, Hamas is authoritarian, and I wonder where that leaves the IRA. I remember there was something about the global war on terrorists. The English were very keen to back us on that, and some of us who were like, hey, the Patriot Act is a bad idea, you might want to rethink that one, were like, hey, what about Ireland and the IRA? But, you know, as somebody in the military once told me, and I am not going to reveal my source on this one, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Take that for what you will. So anyways, democracy through force, you gotta love it, right? Stalin was not so thrilled with this plan, but he really hated the next part, which was the Marshall Plan. So in conjunction with the Truman Doctrine, Secretary of State George Marshall proposed the Marshall Plan, which is also known as the European Recovery Program, which was created to provide American aid to Europe following World War II. This plan was proposed, approved, and implemented basically to ensure that Soviet-style communism did not spread across Europe as it recovered. Additionally, Truman brought in former President Hoover to assist with food programs in Europe. Europe still remembered and loved Hoover for what he had done for them during and after World War I. Hoover gladly did this. He stepped back into his role as savior of the masses and organized food drops for Europe. No problem there. We should be helping people. Now, I don't think Truman was necessarily wrong for any of these plans, all right? I'm not going to go into the geopolitics of the Israel-Palestine conflict. They've hated each other for centuries. Martyr Made is a much better resource for that. We've certainly seen how devastating communism is when implemented, and Europe unquestionably needed assistance as the people were starving. And Stalin began rolling his troops westward to annex various countries that would become the Soviet satellite states behind the Iron Curtain. Truman saw the possibility of another war immediately breaking out as a result of Stalin, and he had, having already alerted Stalin to the presence of atomic weapons and then immediately demonstrated the power of those weapons, I mean, Truman actually drew a pretty solid line in the sand and then proceeded to immediately preclude Europe from having to ask Stalin for assistance by offering it from America first. It was a very shrewd move, but it definitely laid the groundwork for the 40 years Cold War that would follow. And eventually led to the Korean War, Vietnam, the Berlin Wall, the Cuban Missile Crisis. All of this came out. But who's to say it wouldn't have happened anyways, but with more bloodshed if we had done nothing and let Stalin just roll across Europe? We'll never know, right? It's from a historical perspective, it was a shrewd move given what we knew at the time. Now, when 1948 rolled around, Truman was basically the only option for Democrats. Not because he had led brilliantly, he kind of hadn't. They just didn't really have any other options, and the Republicans, of course, ran Thomas E. Dewey, and he really did seem likeliest to win. I mean, the Democrats had been in power for, 32, or at 48, 16 years at this point. And, you know, usually the country doesn't go that long under one party. I mean, it did with the Republicans, but that was post-Civil War, and it took them a while to vote Cleveland in, right? Cleveland was like 20 years post-Civil War. 88. Yeah, about 20 years post-Civil War was Cleveland. Actually, no, I think it was about 16. I don't know. Yeah, it was about 16 years, because Cleveland's first term was 1885, was when he was sworn in the first time. So, yeah, about 16 years seems to be the absolute most that we the people can tolerate one party being in charge, and then we jump ship and go the other way, which... Okay, these last couple elections are the exception to the rule, because it's all just been a giant clusterfuck. So Dewey seemed very likely to win, and this is very famous, of course, that the newspapers were announcing he won before he even won, because, oh my God, Dewey's got to win. And then, obviously, that didn't happen, because here's the thing. Truman was genuinely likable, and on campaign, he made a very good impression overall on the American people, and was more or less a centrist on policy. I mean, basically, everybody could find something to like about him. And when they met him in person, they liked him even more. He was very good at campaigning. The author, Hamby even relays one story where an American couple an American family that was undecided went and saw both candidates, and they voted for Truman because Truman had given their kids autographs, and Dewey couldn't be bothered. He's like, no, I don't have time for that, and just left. So, and on... such small things can fates of nations change, right? The likability of a candidate. And Truman was likable. He was a centrist. He was an everyman. He actually lost the Deep South because he had put forth several policies on civil rights, which the Southern Democrats disapproved of. Now, throughout the book, the author doesn't pick any bones. I mean, he makes it very clear that Truman was, he was a son of Missouri. And Missouri, large tracts of it did not like Abraham Lincoln. His parents were absolutely no exception to that. They thought Lincoln was a horrible human being and that black people were not equal citizens. And Truman's own language reflects that upbringing. And that's all I'm going to say about it because I can't say that word. Even if I were African American, I couldn't say that word because it is such an awful, awful word. However, I am blonde-haired, green-eyed, Scots-Irish American. If I say that word, I will probably be killed in the streets. But y'all know what word I'm talking about. Truman used it quite liberally. He was casually racist. In the way that most Southern Democrats were, and some of them still are. His next 4 years after he won, basically his most popular day ever was when he was sworn in for his second term, because his next 4 years were basically a downslide into unpopularity. Everything he did got negative reviews from everybody, certainly culminating in his removal of MacArthur from command during the Korean War. I don't know enough about the Korean War to have an opinion on if he was right or wrong in that removal. The author believes he was correct in the assessment and removal of MacArthur. The people of the United States at the time believed he was wrong. During his time in the White House, McCarthyism rose, and it's important to note, and it's a good thing to know, that Truman was not a fan of McCarthyism. He never supported it. He thought McCarthy was a bastard, and that he was basically turning everything into a witch hunt. He believed that speech and actions are two very different things, and that free thought was still allowed in the United States, as well as free speech, which is an absolutely refreshing turn of pace 70 years on. One of the other unquestionably good things that he did was he retained control of nuclear weapons and weapons programs. He never released them to the military, and this was a solid choice, and I believe it remains so to this day. Nuclear weapons remain under direct control of the president, so we can't just get a half-cocked army officer out there going, yes, I'm going to press the button and throw us all into war. If it comes down to it, it's going to be the leader of the free world, free is relative, who makes that call and plunges us all into hell. So think carefully, you in the White House, whoever you may be. We all know who it is now, but we don't know who it'll be in January. So we'll see. But that's important. It's important to know that should the shit hit the fan because of us, we have exactly one person to blame for it. Nice. Good Lord, this is a very strong cocktail. Where the hell was I? So his reason for doing so, his reason for opting to keep it in the hands of the president is because he knew how devastating his weapons are. And they kill indiscriminately. And a lot of women and children were killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he knew that. He was well aware of that. And the weight of those deaths were always with him. Now, I think he regretted the deaths. I don't think he ever regretted making the decision, as this ended the war quickly, right? What could have been very protracted ended within 10 days, and no more American loss of life. That's, you know, when you're in charge of American lives, that's appreciated. Full on, man. Now, in 1952, like March, sometime in March 1952, he made the announcement he would not seek a second term for himself. Now, in there, I think it was the 22nd Amendment was passed, which actually limited the president to two terms of office. But because he was sitting when the amendment passed, he would have been the last president who could have run for a third term. And it would have been a second term on his own merit, but still, he was the last one who was basically grandfathered in. He opted not to. He had already served nearly 8 full years in. Roosevelt died only 3 months into his fourth term. So he had served nearly 8, and Bess, and while she did her duty as First Lady, she really didn't like Washington. He briefly considered standing for Senate again, which if he had done so would have made him only the third former president to return to politics directly, the first being John Quincy Adams, who served as congressman from 1830 to 1848. Remember, he's the first congressman to die on the House floor. The second being Andrew Johnson, who served as senator in 1875 until his death in 1875, which I think was actually also in the Senate. But Truman didn't do that. He believed that Bess had supported his career enough, and it was his turn to do something for her. And so he opted to retire, mostly gracefully, and he had some snarky comments to Eisenhower on his way out. He had initially supported Eisenhower as a candidate, but that was before he knew that Eisenhower was a Republican. I mean, nobody knew what Eisenhower's political party was. Truman had actually put Eisenhower in charge of NATO forces and was like, hey, I will totally support your run for president as a Democrat. And then Eisenhower came out as a Republican, and Truman kind of felt betrayed by that. And he chilled toward Eisenhower considerably. The last time the two of them were known to be together, they were actually very courteous to each other, which is good because it was JFK's funeral. So it was good that they were courteous to each other at that time. Truman initially wanted to support Governor Adlai Stevenson II of Illinois, but Stevenson kind of demurred. So Truman was like, no, you know what? Okay, if you don't want my support, my VP Alvin Barkley wants it, so I will support Barkley. But Barkley couldn't get the support of the unions or other Democratic leaders. And when Stevenson opened the 1952 Democratic Convention, it was to wild cheers and impromptu calls for his own nomination. At which point Stevenson quietly phoned Truman and asked if it was too late for his support. And Truman was just kind of exasperated, like, why didn't you say so months ago, of course I support you. But then became very irritated when Stevenson basically ignored all of his advice and his offer of assistance for tried and true politicos. And as Stevenson, of course, lost to Eisenhower, who became the 24th president of the United States. Truman retired to Missouri. He gave some public speeches, oversaw the building of the Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri, traveled to Europe, where he was treated as a hero, which was his due. He can't claim much responsibility for the war in Europe because it was essentially over by the time he took office. But, he authorized the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, and that ensured that Europe was able to recover from the war without fear of Stalinism wiping out what was left of the continent after Hitler's bombs. So he deserved that. I don't want to take that away from him. He may not have fought in the war directly, he may not have been the president in charge of the war, but he certainly made sure that they were able to recover in freedom and relative peace. And he died in hospital in Missouri following multiple organ failures after a bout of pneumonia on December 26, 1972. And he's actually buried on the grounds in his library with Bess, who died about 10 years, buried next to him. From this book, you very much get the sense that Truman was all too human. And not that that's a bad thing, humanity, we're all human, right? But a lot of the politicians, especially when they reach president status, tend to get put on a pedestal of some sort and treated like everything they did was divine and led up to that, and you don't get that sense. I mean, it's likely that he won his own presidential run based on that humanity and the very real recognition that this is a salt of the earth man, right? And if this salt of the earth man could make it to the White House, I mean, he's not a rich man, he's not the son of a rich man, he's not a lawyer, he wasn't even a college graduate, he was just an everyman, then anyone could, right? You know, we certainly have had presidents who are born in rags and rose to riches. Virtually all of them went to law school. But, like, he, more than most of our other presidents, embodied that American dream. But in this book, you also kind of get the sense that he just sort of Forrest Gumped his way through life, finding himself in these ever more responsible positions based on who he knew and his inherent friendliness towards those around him. Because he was a likable guy, and he was able to talk with people on a one-on-one basis. And one of the stories in here is he had like a weekly, bi-weekly poker game, and he didn't really care about winning, so he had these kind of loosey-goosey rules that he made up, and everybody just kind of let him do it because he was the president, and you don't say no to the president. Like, everybody had to contribute toward a general pot that if somebody was unlucky, they could draw from that pot for their buy-in and keep playing. You know, awesome, all right? I mean, good for him. For him, it was about the stories and the connection, not the poker playing. It wasn't about winning or losing. It was about connecting with friends. And that also says a lot about the man. So while he was wildly unpopular as his time in the White House ended, in the intervening decades, his presidency is remembered fondly as good times. And according to Hamby, he is consistently rated in the top 8 presidents. Now, I'm not sure if I quite rank him that high. I mean, he's nowhere near the bottom, I know that. I mean, I kind of need to go through my list to make sure it's updated anyways. I mean, overall, this book was okay. Like, I feel like there's quite a bit of the general knowledge background flavor that didn't necessarily need to be there. I mean, like, pages and pages on the corruption of the Pendergast machine, only to have a few lines that Truman wasn't involved in any of that. And it kind of leaves a sense like, maybe he was, we just haven't found the smoking gun to prove it. And it added nothing to the story. And really, if there's no indication of his involvement, then the pages and pages of Pendergast could have been summed up as, despite well-known corruption in Missouri Democrats, especially the Pendergast machine, there is no indication that Truman was ever a part of that corruption, and he was known to be honest. And like that line that I came up off the cuff while writing this review basically cuts out about 50 pages of text. But overall, it was a solid biography, and it was worth a read if you're looking for information on our 33rd president, Harry S. Truman. And that's it for this week. If you liked what you saw, don't forget to subscribe, and I'll see you guys next Sunday. Bye.